On Sunday, January 22nd at 11 p.m., Suge In My Bowl presents bassist, composer, and producer Melvin Gibbs. Join us as we discuss Melvin Gibbs' career, along with a couple of his projects, including the Zigzag Power Trio and Harriet Tubman. That's Sunday, January 22nd at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. FM and WBAI.org on the web. Suge In My Bowl is the name of this program. My name is Joyce Jones. And our guest for this evening is bassist, composer, producer, Melvin Gibbs. Melvin Gibbs has many projects, but he's presently with the group Harriet Tubman that features our former Suge guest, JT Lewis, drummer, and Brandon Ross on guitar. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Suge In My Bowl continues.
Steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't. I want some sugar.
Thank you. my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with
Melvin Gibbs.
Melvin Gibbs, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
I want to talk about the group later, but I need to thank you now for the Zigzag Power Trio at Winter Jazz Festival. That was amazing, really cool, really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you very much for saying that. I appreciate that. Thank you for coming out.
Oh, indeed. And there was the addition. I'll just ask you about it now. The addition of Upper and Lower Egypt. How did that come about? The Pharoah Sanders song.
That comes about because that's sort of one of the sub-themes of Zigzag Trio. The three of us in the group is that we maintain the thread to our musical forebears, mentors, and musical ancestors. And in the context of the band, we have two that we concentrate on. One is Ronald Shannon Jackson, who both Vernon Reed and I played with. And another one is the guitarist Sonny Chirac, who I played with for a long time. That song actually is a song that Sonny used to play in his set. He actually recorded it on an album after I moved on from the group, but he actually recorded on the original with Pharoah Sanders.
Oh.
He's actually the guitar player on the original, and we used to play it in the set. So I actually suggested to the guys that we play it because I've been playing part of it as a solo piece for a while, and I thought it would be good to hear the rest of it. So that's how it got added to the set.
Well, that was a great surprise.
It's a great song. I always loved this song. And it was a surprise for me when I started playing it with Sonny, because when I had the record that was on, you know, I was still the kid. I wasn't even reading liner notes back then. I didn't even realize he was actually the guitar player on the record. So I, like, went back home and looked at the record. I was like, wow, it is him, you know.
Oh, so. Wow. Cool.
So it was always great to play with him, and it's great to play the song in general. I love playing that song.
So you might as well tell us now the Zigzag Power Trio, which it seems as though you've agreed upon an actual name for the ensemble.
I think, yeah, we have one now.
Okay. How did you come together to play as an ensemble?
Well, you know, that's one of those long time stories. Zigzag Trio is myself on bass, Vernon Reed on guitar, and Will Calhoun on drums. Vernon is one of my oldest friends at this point, and we've been playing music together since before anybody knew who either one of us was outside of the neighborhood. We actually had a little jazz fusion group back in the day when we were both living with our parents. So,
I read that, you know, somewhere. I actually do want to talk more about your relationship to fusion, but you were saying.
As everything moved on and people started becoming famous, we played together with Shannon Jackson, and Vernon started Living Color, and he started doing that. And I guess the years passed, and we hadn't played together. I had done some other stuff with Will Calhoun. We played together with the guitarist John Paul Borelli and some other contexts. And I guess I was already in Rollins' band by then. Kind of just became time for us to do something. Maybe it was actually towards the end of I and I when that happened. So Vernon reached out and said, let's the three of us do something. And we did a show, actually a few shows. And then it kind of didn't happen. It kind of just went away. And I guess was maybe a year ago now, maybe 2 years ago, Vernon was curating at Iridium. And he took the opportunity to say, hey, guys, as part of my curation thing, you guys want to come do a show? Everybody was free, and we all said yes. And we jumped up and did it, and it felt just as good as it always did. So we kept doing it after that.
So what was the time between the Iridium show and the time you played before that?
I don't know, probably 20 years.
Oh, good.
It was somewhere in the 90s, I think, you know.
Wow.
You know, more than 15 years, you know. It's a funny thing because I played with Will, and I played with Vernon many times. But the three of us as a group hadn't done that in close to 20 years.
And now you're filling rooms. The group filled up SOBs very nicely for the Winter Jazz Festival.
Yeah, yeah. It's so much fun to do the group. And Winter Jazz is, it's an interesting thing because there's so much going on. And it's always kind of like, well, okay, how can it, can everybody be everywhere at once? But it worked out well. So, you know, I was happy about it.
Right. Yeah. The Zigzag Power Trio is in the process of working on a recording. I think you're going to do a live retreat kind of thing. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yes, we've been talking about doing something up in Woodstock as part of a series that happens up there that is a whole series that includes a concert, a recording, workshops with the different musicians. It's kind of like a real sort of music intensive in a way.
Wow.
So, you know, we're looking at doing that hopefully in the spring. But in the context of that, we'll be doing some recording for sure. Woodstock Sessions, it's called.
And unfortunately, we don't have anything to play for the listeners with the Power Trio.
So. Yeah, we're kind of like the secret group, and that's why we need to record. We don't have anything legit at this point.
Right, so. Right. I mean, people may have things, but...
Nothing legit yet. Yeah.
In the beginning of your musical development, I guess. How did you come toward bass? How did you wind up playing bass?
Well, bass is the instrument I was always drawn to as a kid, listening to records. That was the thing that always fascinated me about music, was the bass. And I always liked music that makes people move, so I was always interested in what instruments make people do that. So, you know, I'm drawn to bass, percussion, stuff like that. And I started off playing music. I've told the story a few times, but it's still a great story, so I'll tell it again. I actually got into music because of the man who lived next door to me, a man named Papo De Diego, who had a company called Jopa Percussion. And the reason I got into playing music was because of fish.
I'm sorry?
Literally a fish, of guppies, to be exact. I had a little fish tank in the room, and I used to keep guppies, and I kind of got into the habit of finding out more and more about them, and I kind of started experimenting with breeding them and seeing how that worked. And I was coming home from the pet shop with a bag of fish, and I walked in the door, and Papo came walking out, and he saw my fish, and he was kind of like, oh, you keep fish? Yeah. And he said, come in here. And the come in here part is that I grew up in an apartment building in Flatbush, Ditmas Park section of Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And he lived in the apartment next door to me. I had literally never been in his apartment. We'd been living there, I don't know, 5-6 years at that point. I had literally never been in his apartment. The interesting thing about Papo was the guy that all the kids thought was the coolest guy in the neighborhood, because Papo had these really kind of exotic pets. He would come outside, he'd have a parrot perched on his shoulder. At one point, he had this little monkey that he used to carry around. He used to walk around in the streets with a stick. So that was kind of how we saw Papo. For the classic TV people in the audience, we used to call him Beretta because he always reminded us of Beretta. He was like, that's the kind of
with
guy.
With the bird.
Yeah, exactly.
He had the cockatoo. Oh,
exactly. It was that kind of vibe. Except he actually had a parrot. He always had the animal. So I was like thrilled to go in his apartment, and I went in there, and he had like 6-8 fish tanks in there. And it turned out that one of the things he did was money was breed fish. So I was a teenager at the time, and you know, he was kind of like, you want to come in and help me with this? So my brother and I started helping him with his fish business. And my father was the superintendent of the building, so we basically convinced my father to give us some space in the basement so we could expand the business.
Wow.
So he went from like 8 tanks to like 20 tanks, and it became like a real thing. In the process of this, we started talking about life and stuff, and turned out he was actually, his other job was he was a musician, percussionist. Puerto Rican heritage, his specialties were like different Puerto Rican musics, including, you know, bamba and plena, which are the more traditional kind of African music. And I didn't know who Ayerto was at the time, but he used to sub for Ayerto sometimes. So he was a high-level guy. The other thing that was great about him, he introduced me to like real African music, because he had all like the Folkways recordings and UNESCO recordings. I remember particularly he played me this one Folkways record of Music of Cameroon that totally blew my mind, because so many beats happening at once. Because of his influence, I really got more into wanting to play percussion, because he was there and that's what he played. So I actually started off playing congas. That's my original instrument.
Okay.
So, I can still play a little congas. He taught me like how to play a little wawonko and, you know, like I said, bamba and plane and all of that. I know how to do a little bit of that and learn a little shekere and, you know,
learn how to do that.
Yeah. But at one point I told him, I was kind of like, you know, I guess I was doing that about 6 months or so, and I came up to him and said, you know, percussion is cool and everything, but I really kind of want to do something else. And it's kind of like, what do you want to do? I said, well, really, I either want to play bass or be a DJ. And he said to me, you know, one of the classics, you should play bass because there's no creature in that DJing thing.
Okay. You know,
be that as it may, I stuck with the bass.
I read somewhere that you also studied with Reggie Workman.
That was early on, and that was the next step. So after I actually switched up to bass, there was a place out in Crown Heights called The Muse that was kind of like a cultural center that was run by the Positive African Americans of Brooklyn. And part of that was they did a music program there. And the local musicians taught the music program. But the local musicians of Brooklyn were very high-level local musicians.
Exactly.
And Reggie was the one who was teaching bass classes there. So literally, like, my first bass lessons were with Reggie Workman.
Nice.
And I started off on acoustic bass with him. And there was a woman named Miss Lucy, we used to call her, and she was, it's like we called her Miss Lucy. I don't actually remember Miss Lucy's first name either. Somebody, whoever hears this, call and tell me Miss Lucy's first name. Her husband was Larry Lucy, who was one of the guitar players that used to play with Count Basie. He taught guitar there.
Okay.
And Miss Lucy taught electric bass. So Reggie Workman taught acoustic bass, and Miss Lucy taught electric bass. That's who started me off on the instrument. Within doing that, was also a very good friend of Papo's, a man named Vic Colucci, who kind of took me under his wing. I started taking lessons with him, and Vic was very instrumental in my development as a bass player. So that's basically the route. I took lessons with Vic for about a year after the foundational stuff with Reggie and Miss Lucy. About a year with Vic, and one day I came into a lesson, and he was like, no more lessons. I have this gig that I don't want to do anymore. Go do it.
and
that was it. Those were the end of my lessons.
Wow.
Like, there was no more after that.
That was your graduation.
Go learn how to play.
Right.
Yeah, like, go play now.
Wow.
I actually started playing bass last year of high school, which was 75, going up towards 77. Then after 6 months of doing the kind of really stuff, I started getting gigs from other people. So basically, like 2 years after I started, I was actually doing it for real. A little bit of context to that is that I took the instrument very seriously. I didn't practice less than 3 hours a day every day. You know, that was like my minimum. So I was putting in a lot of hours early, quick. And the standard of bass players in the neighborhood was just so high at that time that I was really just trying to catch up, because I didn't start playing till I was 16, and everybody else in the neighborhood was already playing from like 13, 14.
Okay.
So I was just in catch-up mode. But you got to remember, the other part of it was growing up in my neighborhood, the Brooklyn guys had a real rivalry with the Queens guys. We kind of already knew what it was and what our competition was. In our neighborhood, it was guys like Wayne Brathwaite, who was a great bass player who passed, who did all the Billy Ocean stuff. And a lot of the early 80s R&B stuff. I used to call him the root of all evil, because him and his partner produced Kenny G's first record. So that was my nickname for him, you know, root of all evil. So that was the guys from our neighborhood. But then the Queens guys was guys like Omar Hakim and Marcus Miller.
Okay.
We kind of knew what it was. We knew what level we had to get to. And you got to remember, this is before anybody knew who any of us were. But that was the level we were all working at.
Wow.
So for me, as kind of the, even though I was the same age as these guys, I was kind of like the kid, because musically, I was late to the game. I kind of had to really put in the time to kind of catch up. I basically studied privately and taught myself basic theory. And at one point, I decided I needed to go to school. So I went to Meg Evers College, which was right in the neighborhood for me.
Nice.
And that was really where I met the rest of the guys from the neighborhood. And that's where I met Vernon.
Okay.
Through my friend Gary Fritz, who was in the school ensemble. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gary is like the node. He's like the connection between many different worlds.
Uh-huh.
So through Gary, that's how I met Vernon, because they had a band together. Even before I knew Vernon, they had a band. Me and Vernon kind of hit it off because we're both kind of nerdy and, you know, we're interested in different stuff. So kind of like we just became like great friends, and it grew into, you know, him deciding he wanted to do a band, and he asked me to be in it, and I joined. And it was a band called Point of View. It's the basic kind of jazz fusion band.
Yeah, that jazz fusion thing, apparently that's where you gravitated. That's what you were listening to at that time.
Well, among many things.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to balance that off, because in the meantime, we had like our own little like funk band in the neighborhood that was actually quite good. And in the meantime, that neighborhood was, as it still is, it's like a hub for the Caribbean people. So just to kind of hang out with the guys in the neighborhood, I had to get well-versed in soca, calypso, compa too, because there's Haitians in the neighborhood, and obviously reggae. So I became versed in all of these musics just because that's what it was around the block. But for us of our generation, we were drawn to the, being teenagers, you know, we were drawn to the sports aspect of jazz fusion, you know.
What does that mean?
Very complicated.
What do you mean, sports aspects of jazz fusion?
Well, you know, it's like the Olympics, like fast and complicated to do, you know. It's like doing triple somersaults or whatever, you know what I mean? So as kids, that was the thing that really drew us in about that music. I mean, obviously, the musical part was there because, you know, luckily for us, we kind of have taste in music. So the musical part was interesting to us as well. But I think what drew me as much was the fact that it was this very virtuosic music that kind of would prove a point that we knew how to play it.
Right.
What's interesting for me personally was I kind of grew tired of that, you know, and I kind of started looking for more musically. And for me, I kind of knew I'm kind of a misfit. At that point, my friends were already starting to play with people who were famous. I just kind of knew that that wasn't really my path, you know, being like a just standard R&B bass player.
Right.
And I also knew that the fusion thing, as it stood at that time, wasn't that rewarding to me. So I kind of started looking for different things to do. And kind of almost by accident, just because I was looking for different things to do, I ended up in a group with a couple of guys who were playing with Ornette Coleman. And they introduced me to Ornette Coleman's musical theories.
Harmelotics,
yes. And at one point, one of the guys was the guitar player, Burnett, who was in Primetime. And at one point, after rehearsal with this band, he pulled out some music and said, hey, take a look at this thing. And it was really crazy music, because it didn't have any staff. You couldn't tell what clef it was, which is, you know, he's kind of, we just played this thing. Mm-hmm. He said, yeah, I think you can play hard melodic. My friend is looking for a bass player. You should come down. And that was Shannon Jackson. So that's how I started playing with Shannon. And literally 2 or 3 weeks after that, I was doing a reggae gig at this club in Tribeca. And an old friend of mine walked in who was literally in the first band I was ever in, a guitar player, and we started talking. And he said to me, what are you doing, man? I said, you know, I'm doing my thing. I'm doing this thing, you know. And I'm also playing with this interesting drummer, this guy named Ronald Shannon Jackson. He said, wow. He said, I'm playing with James Flood Ulmer.
Oh, wow.
So we hooked back up again. And he's the one who introduced me to Blood. And that was another great friend of mine, a man who passed on, a man named Alfonia Timms. I'm going to tell one of my other great stories. After me and Alfonia hooked back up, he had a little trio. And we did a couple of rehearsals. And one day he called me and he said, hey, you know, we're going to go rehearse on Prince Street today. And he gave me the address. And I was kind of like, okay, great. And, you know, I go to the place and I'm kind of like, Prince Street, why does that sound familiar? So I get there and I go in. And when I get there, I realize why it sounded familiar. That's where Ornette Coleman lives.
Right.
Yeah, so... So we get there, and Ornette opens the door. I come strolling in, and it turns out that we were basically giving a command performance for Ornette.
Oh, you know? My.
So basically, we played Alfonia's set for an audience of one Ornette, you know. And Ornette sat politely and listened to us play through all of Alfonia's music. And at the end, his first comment was, Melvin, where'd you learn how to play like that? And I was kind of like, I don't know, just how I play. And at that point, I realized, well, okay, he's kind of giving me the seal of approval here. It's kind of like, you know, I fell in with that crowd. I did a couple of things. I never actually played in prime time, but basically Ornette kind of supervised. Alfonia became Ornette's protege, so I spent a lot of time around Ornette, and Ornette helped Alfonia with his music. He gave good feedback, and that was kind of concurrent with me playing with Shannon. That was kind of my big musical education at that time.
I've seen the name Alfonia Timms as I was reading about you, and I see that there is a recording that you did with Alfonia Timms under the group name of Alfonia Timms and his Flying Tigers.
Yeah, that was his bigger group, and that's the other part of the story was Alfonia was kind of a hothead.
No.
I love the brother, but he was kind of a hothead, and after a while, he kind of fell out with Ornette, and the group had kind of petered out for a bit, and then that was kind of around the time the defunk was happening. It was all of this was kind of happening at once, so I kind of got into the whole defunk thing and was doing all of that, and then Alfonia called me and said, hey, man, come down to rehearsal. I'm kind of like, great, we're doing this again. Again, another classic Alfonia, come down to West Beth, which I'd never been before, so we get on the West Beth, which is this artist residency building on West Street and Bethune Street in the village.
Right.
So we go down there and we're rehearsing, and towards the end of rehearsal, this old dude walks in, and I'm kind of like, okay, who's this old dude? I wonder why he's here. So we stop playing, and then Alfonia's like, hey, Melvin, I want you to meet Gil. And then I looked at the old dude, and I'm kind of like, oh, this is Gil Evans. So Alfonia went from Ornette to Gil.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And Gil did the same thing that Ornette did. So, but part of that was because the group expanded because of that influence. And the trio became this much larger group of Flying Tigers, and that's the group that recorded. And as you can see, I'm not on that whole album, like I said, because at that point I was doing a bunch of stuff. But it was the same thing. Through Alfonia, I got to meet Gil, got to hang with Gil for a bit, and got to get the blessings of being able to call him on the phone once in a while when I had some questions about music, which was invaluable, you know.
I also read that you had a relationship with Gil's sons as well.
Yeah, the kids were great. The funny part of this is where the circle reconnects, because Noah is a bass player, and Noah had a hardcore band.
Oh.
And the drummer for his hardcore band was Mackie, who was at that time in a group called the Cro-Mags.
Uh-huh.
And they were the ones who actually introduced me to the music of the Bad Brains.
Right.
It was over at Gil Evans' house is where I heard the Bad Brains the first time.
Nice.
And these are the elements that kind of go into what Zig Zag is doing in a way, because you've got the free jazz, you've got the hardcore. It's these, all of these things together in form. So fast forwarding a gazillion trillion years, so looking at the idea of what jazz fusion is, it's informed by our lives, you know, and that's not to mention Vernon's take on all of that, what he did. But so when I think about what the music of Zig Zag is, to call it jazz fusion, you kind of have to add in this addendum of it's got all of our life experience, which is a whole different life experience than informed when we were doing it back when we were kids. And it also a different set of life experiences, because fusion has actually kind of made a comeback in the last couple of years, cut through the Brain Feeder guys have kind of brought it back.
Yes.
You know,
that would be sound, like Kamasi and Kamasi Washington and folks like that?
Yeah, folks like that. Yeah. So that kind of sound, that kind of like post, kind of Return to Forever, kind of, like I said, like Olympics music.
Right,
you know,
it right.
Kind of made a comeback.
Right.
But I think the thing for us now is that we really kind of have this other thing that we add to it that is not, obviously, we're not the first generation of guys to do this music, but we have a whole other set of information within it that I think is very interesting.
Thank you.
tell me about the addition of Ronald. I keep reading, it's like it's either Ronald Shannon Jackson or Shannon Jackson, as you're referring to him. What's the story with regard to his name? Why are we seeing two different things here?
Well, it's like I've since forgotten. He did actually told me why, because at one point when he was recording with, back in the days with Albert Ali, he did record under the name Ronald Jackson.
Okay. Like,
but I always knew him as Shannon,
okay.
I believe. You know, I don't want to talk out of turn, so
mm-hmm.
I guess I'll just take the fifth on that. Now, I won't even say the fifth, because it's not like I don't know, but I don't remember the exact story.
Okay.
You know, I used to call him Shannon. That's what I called him. That's what all his friends call him.
What I was wondering, though, just that period of when you're playing with Ronald Shannon Jackson and meeting Ornette Coleman and Gil Evans, and I guess it's like a time in New York. You have Power Tools. You're playing with John Zorn, and, you know, there's all of this period, I guess, in the 80s. Could you speak to that time in New York?
Yeah, I'll speak to that time in New York. I would back it up a little bit, because, I mean, it really bleeds in from the late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of have the pinpoint year of 81 that kind of everybody kind of concentrates on in New York as the kind of turning point year. I think for me, from my side, again, going back to being friends with Gary Fritz and even going back to my teenhood, what happened in New York then is that New York kind of discovered that it had black people and they were interesting.
Oh, wow.
You know?
Good point.
I mean,
yes.
You know, it's like that's back when people were tagging the trains and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they just had a movie that just came out called Wall Riders that Gary is actually fairly prominently featured in. Because Gary is actually one of the first graffiti artists whose art was shown in the gallery.
Really?
You know?
Gary Fritz.
Yes, the same Gary Fritz, a.k.a.
Oh, wow.
Richard Gary, head of the ex-Vandals.
Wow.
So it was a time when all of that was happening, you know, Last Poets, the East, now the African Street Fair. I mean, all of that was happening. So that's kind of the scene that I came up under. And I was always into different music. I was also a record collector. I'm kind of trying to tie this together. There was a store. I was telling you, we had the local funk band. The drummer used to live on Nostrand near Fenimore. There was a store there called the African Record Center.
Oh.
And that was very interesting because it was literally that. It was like records from Africa. And he was the person who actually imported Sailor's records to the States. So I was listening to that music back then as well. Things like Sailor, Lafayette Afro Rock Band, Mount of Divine Gods. So I was listening to all of that kind of stuff because I was kind of like I said, I wanted to be a DJ. So I was up on all of this stuff. So what happened was when the cultural elite of New York started discovering what was happening in the hood, the whole scene blossomed. Not so much Gary and his crew, but the next set of guys younger than them became like famous artists, the most prominent being Jean Michel,
mm-hmm.
who was from Flatbush, by the way. And
Busky,
so,
I thought those.
Yeah, who's from the neighborhood. And I always say to people, when I talk about people I know, it starts to sound like I'm name dropping, but we're literally all kids from the neighborhood. That's just how fertile the neighborhood was back then. I'm coming up through there, and because I'm sort of the outlier of my block, you know, my guys are playing with people like Angie Beaufield and Norman Connors and all of that. I'm the one who's playing with, you know, Lester Bowie and mm-hmm. Rashid Ali. I kind of went up in that zone.
Right.
And those set of people, and I met from being in what was called the Loft Jazz scene back then, you
mm-hmm.
know, I met all the guys from St. Louis, and I started playing with all of those guys. And that the crossover between the St. Louis jazz musicians and the white guys of the downtown scene, that was a very critical moment for both of those scenes, because mm-hmm. Defunct came up out of that scene. people started going to the Roxy and finding out about DST and what was going on in the Bronx, you know, that whole scene. So the Bronx scene started bleeding into the Manhattan scene. Musically, the guys from the Bronx came in. The Brooklyn Taggers started coming in. So it started becoming this thing where they started kind of really paying attention to what we were doing musically. And for me, it sounds kind of messy. Just trying to talk to it, I realize as I'm saying it, this is going to sound like it's kind of all over the place. But I would say to the people listening, this was just, we didn't put the same boundaries up around music back then that people do now. And the other thing, me and Vernon, we used to go to Garage.
The house music place, quote unquote house music.
You know, they called it loft music back then because the place before there was the Garage, those guys used to spin at the loft.
Right.
And then one of them moved to Chicago.
Right.
And started spinning at a place called the Warehouse.
Right.
And that's when... That's how the name. That's why house music is called house music. It was actually one of the guys from the Garage who moved to Chicago.
Right.
So you have these multiple cultural collisions happening. Again, in those days, there wasn't that boundary between hip-hop and dance music that there is now. Basically, what you could call breakbeat culture had started by then. People were doing remixes and looping stuff with tape and all of that. But it wasn't like, okay, you rap to slow music and you dance to fast music. The boundaries hadn't been made yet. So all of this was happening simultaneously. I guess I should say now, and a lot of that was eye-opening for me. I was a kid from Brooklyn. As a kid, I went to church every Sunday, blah, blah, blah. I mean, what did I know about hanging till 3 o'clock in the morning? Or that gay guys had clubs, you know?
Right.
You know, it's kind of like I didn't. But I guess how it relates to the music is like all of these things were bleeding into each other. And for me, I knew all of this information. So from my end as a musician, in a certain way, I was kind of a hub for the guys at that time. So on one hand, I was playing with the No Wave guys because I knew enough about what they were trying to do that I could play with them. On the other hand, I was playing with all the free jazz guys because my other thing was I was kind of like the guy the older guys would call when they wanted some funk in their music. I was playing up in Harlem with guys like Ronnie Smith. So I became that same guy downtown. So I started playing with guys like Lester, Joe, Bowie, and the whole St. Louis crew. And so for me, it was a very fertile time. For the music, it was a very fertile time because you had these two different cultures coming together and seeing each other. And from the African-American side, it was already so fertile. There wasn't really anything, you know, the other side could add to be blunt. But I think it made a big impact on the downtown scene in general in terms of music.
Sure.
And the downtown scene became a good vehicle for a lot of the guys musically.
To WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl is the name of this program. My name is Joyce Jones. And our guest for this evening is bassist, composer, and producer Melvin Gibbs, who is also a member of the group Harriet Tubman. The On the Bandstand segment will be coming up next, and our associate producer Hank Williams will be sharing information about an event that's coming up where Harriet Tubman CD release event that's happening in February. What you're listening to right now is Shortly Take Off from Mark Rebo's Rootless Cosmopolitans release. What you heard before that is Melvin's tune, which is also written by Melvin Gibbs, from his group Defunct. That's from Thermonuclear Sweat. Before that, we heard Hemlock for Cordials, that's from Ronald Shannon Jackson's Street Priest release. Before that, we heard the title track from Barbecue Dog, also by Ronald Shannon Jackson. Before that, we heard the title track from Street Priest, also from, as mentioned, by Ronald Shannon Jackson. Melvin Gibbs is featured on all of these recordings, and we will hear more from Melvin Gibbs after the On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer, Hank Williams. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Shivya My Bowl continues.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for January 22nd. This segment features aerial listings of Sugar in My Bowl guests so you can see them live. And this week's show features bassist Melvin Gibbs. You can see him at Brooklyn's Shapeshifter Lab on February 16th, or at The Stone on the Lower East Side on February 18th with drummer J.T. Lewis and Harriet Tubman. Now, let's get to the rest of our music listings. We start this week with bassist Mimi Jones, who hosts a jam session in the late set at Smoke on January 23rd and 30th. You can also catch her leading her own sextet at Monmouth University in New Jersey on February 4th. Drummer Andrew Surreal is at the Whitney Museum on the 23rd and 27th for the Sound and Colors studio sessions. Drummer and percussionist Will Calhoun has a CD release event for his Elvin Jones tribute at the Blue Note from the 24th through the 26th. Saxophonist Robbie Coltrane joins Calhoun as a special guest on the 24th. Master drummer Michael Carvin is at St. Peter's Church as part of a musical tribute to the late vibraphonist Bobby Hutcherson on the 28th. Tuba player Howard Johnson is at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem for a 75th birthday performance, and that's on January 29th. Bassist Christian McBride is also at the Jazz Museum, and he'll be talking about his recording career for part one of the Session Stories on the 31st. Vocalist Carmen Lundy is at Birdland from the 31st through February 4th. Organist John Medeski has a residency at The Stone from the 31st through February 5th. Vocalist Catherine Russell is at Jazz at Lincoln Center's Rose Theater on February 4th, and that's part of the family concert series Who is Louis Armstrong? Guitarist Mark Rebo is at Sonny's in Red Hook, Brooklyn on February 9th. Finally, drummer and percussionist Will Calhoun's gallery exhibit of his visual art collaboration Azza continues at the Bronx Music Heritage Center through February 11th. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website, and Suga is spelled S-U-G-A. If you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too, and we'd appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. If you like what we do, please help WBAI stay on the air by pledging whatever you can, and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. The support WBAI link on our website has details. This is Hank Williams signing off with our bi-weekly schedule. We're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on WBAI on Sunday, February 5th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
WBAI University of the Air and the New York Shakespeare Reading Group will be holding a reading of William Shakespeare's play, Richard III. This reading is open to all to participate in. Please bring a copy of the play and food and drink to share with all. It will be held on Saturday, January 28th at 12 p.m. at the Atrium located at 60 Wall Street in Lower Manhattan. All are welcome to read together out loud Shakespeare's play, Richard III, Saturday, January 28th at 12 p.m. at the Atrium at 60 Wall Street in Lower Manhattan. Take the 2, 3, 4, or 5 train to Wall Street. Bring the play and food and drink to share.
And they'll all cow, cow.
Hi. How's your mama? Hi, this is Roy Ayers. When I'm in New York, I listen to WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
Oh.
speaking of the downtown scene, Ardo Lindsay is associated with the downtown scene.
Yes.
How did you get into playing with him?
Well, that, again, as you said, he's associated with the downtown scene, and that's how I know him. In the early days, I was playing with a man named James Chance,
mm-hmm.
who was one of the, there was an album that came out called No Wave,
mm-hmm.
in New York, and there are four groups on that album. And one of them was James Chance, the other one was Ardo with DNA, right?
Okay.
So Mars was the third one, and I forget who the fourth one was. So I knew these people from the scene, because
mm-hmm.
at that point I was actually a part of that scene. But I had never actually heard Ardo's music. But we were playing a lot in this club called the Squat Theater, downtown New York on 23rd Street. And I went there one day to go pick up some clothes, actually, because I was playing there every week, so it kind of started becoming like home, and I had stuff there, so I went to go pick up some stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I go in, and I hear this incredible noise. Turned out it was DNA rehearsing. And I was really taken by the group, so I kind of hung around and introduced myself. They knew who I was. I knew who they were, and me and Ardo kind of hit it off. And I guess years later, when he decided he wanted to do something different, he reached out to me, and we started doing stuff, and we've been doing ever since. That was more towards like 84, 85. We started doing stuff, and we've been doing stuff since.
And somewhere, at some point, I've heard your name associated with being a co-founder of Black Rock Coalition. Is that accurate? Or there were so many co-founders? It was a collective.
Well, it's one of those things, you know, it's almost like the early history of graffiti, which is actually finally in the process of being copied, rewritten. Anybody can say they were there. The people who are actually in the room know who was in the room.
Right. You know?
I mean, to say that I was a co-founder is not accurate because I was not in the room when they decided. The three co-founders are Vernon Reed, mm-hmm. Condon Mason, and Greg Tate.
Right.
But my group, I&I, was the actual inspiration for the group, for the coalition to start, yes.
Oh, how is that?
Well, Vernon came to one of our gigs and the turnout was kind of dismal and he decided he needed to do something. So we put the organization together. So I'm one of the founding members. Again, people who know, you know, I was at the first meeting. So
okay.
People who were at the first meeting knows who was at the first meeting.
Okay.
But basically, the idea of the group was based around making sure that groups like I&I had an opportunity to shine.
So that was similar to AACM, very AACM-like.
Yes, and even before, there's a little history to that because we had a little group in Brooklyn before that we call Kona, Coalition of New Artists, that predates the BRC that a bunch of us were in, and one of the members was Sapphire, who wrote the book.
Push.
That, yes, she was one of the members of that.
Okay.
Yeah. So this was 3 or 4 years before BRC started. And we've always been inspired by AACM and BAG. I mean, mm-hmm. It was the same idea.
Yes.
So Vernon has always been that guy. So he put his foot down and made it happen.
Got it.
But, you know, the backstory comes, again, from Fritz's house. This is where all of this stuff was born. You know,
oh, my goodness.
And it comes from that conversation of the set of people who were around at that time, you know. Mm-hmm. Myself, you know, Gary, DK Dyson, you know, we were the original crew. And, of course, Tate, you know, coming from D.C., where organizing for African American empowerment was coming up out of Howard. That was kind of what he's supposed to do.
Right.
So they made it happen.
Harriet Tubman.
Okay. Well, that one, that's one of them ones I kind of hitched a ride, basically.
Oh.
I mean, this was after Poe Rollins Band era.
Henry Rollins, you know. Yes.
I guess Brandon and JT had been playing together, and they wanted a third person, so I guess Brandon had suggested, because I had been playing in Brandon's groups in the 80s and stuff. I guess Brandon suggested that they reach out to me, and they did. And JT had actually toured with Defunct back in the 80s. The one tour I actually did with Defunct, he actually played drums in that.
Okay.
I knew them both, but I hadn't played with either one of them, because the 90s, everybody was busy being rock stars or whatever, so we all had stuff to do then. You know?
Right.
Well, you know, everybody was, Brandon was running around Cassandra. You know, JT was running around being, you know, playing with, you know, Sting. He was
Don Cullen.
He was up in that world.
Right.
And I was doing Rollins bands. I guess we all decided we wanted to kind of get back kind of to our roots, and we wanted to get with other people who understood the totality of our influences, somebody who wasn't scared to put the ACM together with Jimi Hendrix or whatever, or who wasn't scared to pair Ornette Coleman with P-Funk or whatever, you know what I mean? Again, going back to the early 80s thing, somebody who thought the way we did back in the early 80s, where that boundary just was kind of irrelevant. So that's kind of why that came together.
And you have something new coming on February 24th.
Yes, on February 24th, we have a record called Araminta, which is Harriet Tubman's birth name. Araminta Ross was her birth name.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the three of us with a special guest, Wadada Leo Smith, the great trumpet player,
yes,
ACM member, mentor to many people, you know, including us. It's kind of like the thread, again, for us in general, is intergenerational. And I'm actually really happy with the record. I think it's a great document. I kind of feel, for better or worse, we've been doing the group a long time. It's coming up on 20 years now. And when we did it, it was kind of like, calling the band Harriet Tubman was kind of like, why would three black men call a band? Who's Harriet Tubman? You know what I mean? It was like
right.
That. It was like, why are you guys named after a woman? You know? And the people who knew were kind of like, oh, they're just some angry militants. You know, it's kind of like, it was kind of like, but now it's kind of the world is kind of where we're at the point where people kind of get it now. Okay, yeah, it's kind of like all the things that we were seeing back then about the world, people are kind of ready to engage with it.
Right.
You know, ready to engage with the idea of, yeah, a bunch of men can big up a African-American female and it's a good thing. They're
right.
Ready to engage with the idea that, yeah, Black Lives Matter, you know,
right.
And it's not like, ooh, anymore. So, and I think musically it's the same. Putting together the elements that we put together is not so controversial as it was. And it's a new generation coming up of jazz musicians and a new generation of thought around these things that influence what makes the music. The whole conservative thing that blew into the music for so long, I feel like that's basically, it's not gone, but I feel like the strength has definitely waned. So some of the more creative elements are blooming again now, and we're part of that, which is always what we've been repping. And I think particularly for males of my generation, we have a lot to offer the youth because we were fighters. I knew Panthers, you know what I mean? Those are the people who kind of mentored us to think and taught us to think about the world a certain kind of way. And the world kind of needs that energy right now. So I feel like that being the case, musically, people are going to kind of get what we're doing in a different kind of way.
Well, Harriet Tubman also has a gig coming up as part of Brandon's residency at the Stone on February 18th.
Harriet Tubman will be there, and we have two special guests. We have Wadada Leo Smith, who's on the Araminta record, and we also have Alicia Moran.
That's right.
Who's going to be singing some, I believe the ideas will be looking at some of the Negro spiritual stuff, the early turn of the century Negro music.
I think you were trying to say Alicia Hall Moran.
Exactly.
Yes, it's like there's a third name somewhere.
Yeah, Alicia Hall Moran. And Alicia's going to come and bless us with her voice. Mm-hmm. And the record is dropping February 24th. I just want to say the record is already available for advance purchase.
Yes, it is.
You go to sunnysidezone.com.
That's right.
You can find the record there.
And you can actually get two. There are two selections that we're going to be playing, the two that we can access. There are two selections. The Spiral Path to the Throne is one of the selections that you can get, and also Real Cool Killers.
Yes, which is a really nice trio piece. Thank you. I like both of those pieces. I like Real Cool Killers because to me that's real Brooklyn. It's really kind of the things I was saying about the combination of the Jamaican element. I feel like that's like one of my little contributions to this music is kind of bringing that real sort of like Jamaican influence, walking church and Flatbush sound. That's a real church and Flatbush song right there. Church Avenue and Flatbush Avenue. Church, which Church Avenue is now called Bar Molly Boulevard or whatever, you know, on those two blocks.
So is it really? I haven't been there in so long now. Okay.
Yeah, it's now called Bar Molly. So it's got a bit of that. One thing I should mention, there is another project that I've been working on this year.
Yes, please.
I've been working a lot with the scientist Stefan Alexander, who last year released a book called The Jazz of Physics.
Yes. I'm saying yes because I remember the troops hosted a salon, and he was there. As a matter of fact, Will Calhoun was there as well, and I think he was the musical component for that presentation.
Yes. So Stefan and I have been working on music based around the ideas in his book, and we've done a couple of performances based around talks that he's done around the book. Mm-hmm. But we're actually going to do more a concert. Usually it's like a talk with a concert. We're going to do the reverse. We're going to do a concert with a talk. And it's going to be a bunch of musical ideas that I've been working on based off of some of the ideas in his book. And the group will consist of Stefan on saxophone, myself on bass, a keyboard player who's currently studying mathematics in Brown, but he's a really great keyboard player who was in one of the Thelonious Monk Institute jazz bands, a kid named Miles Van Thongren. He's going to come play piano, and Will Calhoun's going to be the drums.
Excellent.
Playing drums.
Oh, wow.
And that will be February 16th at Shapeshifter Lounge. So that week is kind of crowded. So people got two things to come to that week.
Yeah.
Come to the 16th to check out me and Stefan, and come on the 18th to check out Tubman with Alicia Hall Moran and Wadada Smith.
That's Thursday the 16th and Saturday the 18th. That's going to be
that's a crowded
some
week.
Fun stuff, yeah.
And
you can find out more about the Shapeshifter Lab event at shapeshifterlab.com.
Stefan, we're still working on the book when we met. And we've been talking about ideas for a while now. It felt like once the book dropped, it was time to kind of start moving on actualizing the things.
So, Melvin Gibbs, bassist, composer, all about. Hey, you know, there's one project I really wanted to talk to you about. And I guess I missed my opportunity. It happened in 2010. We're talking now. But I did want to know about that. The Ancestors Speak. Ancient Speak.
Yeah, Elevated Entity, yeah. You know, that was an interesting project.
Bye-bye!
the short version of that is Amayo, the lead singer of Antibalas, and I have been talking, and we will do something that will basically be in that vein.
Oh.
That's a project that we're going to work on.
Okay.
That's something that will be happening this year. But the basic idea, the short version of that project was I kind of wanted to explore different ways of looking at African spirituality that weren't necessarily constricted by the Christian frame. So I kind of looked at some of the different traditions of music. And for this record, I kind of looked at the different Yoruba-based traditions, going back to Cuba, going back to Brazil, and going back to Nigeria. And I spent a lot of time in Salvador de Bahia, Brazil, went out to record some music in the field there and incorporated a lot of that into the music, a lot of the field recordings into the album itself. Also had the great Cuban singer slash percussionist Pedrito Martinez come in and sing here. He came and sang on a couple of things. And I had Amayo, the singer from the band Antibalas, who's Nigerian, who's deep into the religion and it's still living form in Nigeria. I had him come sing on a couple of things as well.
Yeah, I really like that. You had a lot of folks on this one. To not get into the many people who were on here, but I do have to say, you even had Pete Cozy on.
Yeah, Pete was on there. Yeah, I managed to get Pete on there. That was a great thing.
Yeah. It's a nice document, a nice document of your work. And of that investigation or research.
Sure.
one of the common threads with all of these things is kind of like, I really like to keep the music intergenerational. And the further back I can go and forward, I can go and keep the commonality. That's kind of what's interesting to me. You know, something that somebody who's 16 can get into and somebody who's 60 can get into. I mean, that's how we used to listen to music. When I was a kid, everybody kind of listened to the same music, and I kind of like that thing. I mean, now it's so stratified. A 15-year-old won't listen to a music that a 19-year-old will listen to, you know. But I'm really interested in making music that actually kind of brings a community of people together. That was definitely the aim of what I was doing with the Ancient Speaks, one of the aims. There's a few, but, you know, that's a whole story. But that could be its own interview. But the main point, the main point is this idea of bringing a community together. And I feel like that was accomplished on that record.
Well, that's always a good thing, especially these days in the, yeah. Well, every day. But I guess it's more apparent for more people these days.
Yeah, that's what I was saying earlier about Tubman. I mean, these ideas, they were kind of outlier ideas. But to me, community and making sure that everybody looks out for each other, and even within that, giving people a chance to grow, you know what I mean? It's kind of like allowing imperfection, you know, allowing people to have their process, allowing things, you know, that's how things move forward.
Right.
And I've been to so many situations where people say, those kids. I'm like, no, those they're not those kids. They're our kids.
Right.
It's up to us to reach out. You know, it's up to us to make the connection. To the extent that I can do that with my music, I definitely try to. That's important to me.
So, Melvin Gibbs, is there anything else you want to share with the WBAI listening audience that we may not have talked about already?
I think, you know, there's a lot to chew on there. I'm pretty happy with this.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining Sugar and My Bowl. I really appreciate all the time that you've spent with us. And I'm glad we had the opportunity.
I'm definitely glad you reached out. I'm glad we have. Thank you for the support, peace and love, and all of that.
Excellent. All right. Thanks a lot. Peace.
Okay. Bye-bye.
You think you're going to live your life alone, in darkness, in seclusion. Yeah, I know. You've been out there, tried to mix with those animals, and it just left you full of humiliated confusion. So you stagger back home and wait for nothing. But the solitary refinement of your room spits you back out onto the street, and now you're desperate and in need of human contact. And then you meet me, and your whole world changes. Because everything I say is everything you've ever wanted to hear. So you drop all your defenses and you drop all your fears. And you trust me completely. I'm perfect in every way. As I make you feel so strong and so powerful inside, you feel so lucky. But your ego obscures reality, and you never bother to wonder why things are going so well. You wanna know why? 'Cause I'm a liar! Yeah, I'm a liar! I'll tear your mind out! I'll burn your soul! I'll turn you into me! I'll turn you into me! 'Cause I'm a liar! A liar! A liar! A liar!
I'll hide behind a smile. Standing eyes, and I'll tell you things that you already know, so you can say, I really identify with you.
You're listening to the closing moments of Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. Our guest for this evening was Melvin Gibbs, bassist, composer, and producer. And what you're listening to right now is Liar from the Rollins Band. Before that, we heard Mojuba, which features Amayo and John Medeski. That is from Ancients Speak. Melvin Gibbs' Elevated Entity is the name of the ensemble. Before that, we heard Canto por Adudua, which features Pedrito Martinez and Pete Cozy, which is also from Ancients Speak. Before that, we heard Adapted from Harriet Tubman's I Am a Man. Before that, we heard Real Cool Killers from Harriet Tubman's latest release, Araminta. Before that, we heard another release from Araminta, The Spiral Path. The release date for Araminta is February 24th, and there will be a CD release event at The Stone, which is actually part of Brandon Ross's residency. You can go to shugginmybowl.org and check our blog for more information. Before that, we heard Invoke from Ardo Lindsay's Encyclopedia of Ardo. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa coming up next. Shuggin' My Bowl will be back on February 5th, right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Now I see the destructive power of a lie. They're stronger than truth. I can't believe I ever hurt you. I swear, I will never lie to you again. Please, just give me one more chance. I will never lie to you again. I swear. I will never tell a lie. I will never tell a lie. No.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.